This is, I don't know, the fourth talk, I think, of the Range Retreat. Roughly about the fourth talk of the Range Retreat of 2002. And again, I'd like to point out in this Dhamma talk another aspect of the Dhamma which is very conducive to success in meditation. As many of you who have heard me talk before know, that I focus on the practice of meditation rather than the theory of the Dhamma, simply because it's much more effective to find out these truths for oneself. In fact, very often it's the only way to truly understand and penetrate these truths, is actually to see them in the mind's eye, in the clarity of deep meditation. And without those experiences of deep meditation, without the data which those experiences provide for you, sometimes it's next to impossible to truly fathom the meaning of the Buddha's words. You can read the suttas, you can study Pali, but to actually to experience those states and those dhammas which the Buddha was talking about is truly the only way to illuminate them and make them real for you. So, emphasizing again the process of meditation, the aspect I want to talk about this evening is to remind everybody of the power of basic mindfulness. Very often in one's meditation there is a lack of success, simply because one doesn't establish the mindfulness properly first of all. And that mindfulness, as some of you have heard me talk before, has two factors to it. Strictly speaking, what I'm talking about here this evening is not just sati, but sati sampajanya, or as the Thai forest teachers used to always say, satipanya. I understand from the teachings of those forest masters and also from the suttas that those two terms mean the same, they're pointing to the same thing. One was used by the Buddha, the other one was used by the later Thai forest monks, satipanya or sati sampajanya. And what that really means, the sati part of that, is the bare awareness, the full knowing of what's going on, the clarity of the mind. And the sampajanya or the panya part of it is actually remembering these instructions, remembering what you're supposed to be doing, how to deal with the states of mind as they come up in a wise way, which leads to the goal of deep meditation, of letting go, renunciation, peace, bliss, and freedom. So it's important to recall those qualities and to build them up even before you practice the meditation. And very often in many forest monasteries, that practice of day-by-day mindfulness in ordinary activities, is emphasized as something which is a foundation for the mindfulness which is required when one sits on one's stool or cushion in meditation. Because without that mindfulness in daily activities, that recollection and knowing where you are, knowing what's going on, instead of being lost in thoughts, fantasies, plans or dreams. But knowing where one is, what's going on, is an important factor for the success in meditation later on. Remember that each one of these faculties, such as meditation or mindfulness or wisdom, these faculties are things which you train yourself to develop inside of you. They're not things which, in the sense, of your birthright. These are things which you cultivate and develop throughout the day. And in particular, mindfulness, that awareness, bringing your attention into the present moment, where you are, what you're doing, is a factor which the monastic lifestyle should engender, simply because of all the rules which we have to keep. The rules of the monastery, what we call the kawat from the Thai word, these are the local rules here. The rules of deportment, you know, the rules of the way of washing the bowl, like being quiet, not talking so much. These general rules of a monastery are things which help the establishment of the moment-by-moment mindfulness. So for those of you who are having difficulty with your meditation and success is not as much as you think it might be, then check to see what you are doing outside of your meditation. Whether you are recollecting the moment, whether you are being mindful and fully aware as much as you possibly can in each and every moment, or whether you are being lost in thoughts, fantasies, dreams, and distractions. Again, it's one of the basic teachings of the forest tradition to eat little, sleep little, and talk little. And that talk little there is so important, because the more that one talks, usually the less mindfulness there is, the less listening there is. And that aspect of listening, being alert, being receptive to what's going on, is one of the most powerful parts of mindfulness. So when one can develop that mindfulness throughout the day in just general activities, listening, feeling, experiencing, being in the present moment, then it becomes much easier when you sit down and do your sitting meditation or walking meditation. You've all heard me talk about the processes of meditation, the stages of meditation, starting off with present moment awareness. That present moment awareness should be something established throughout the day, no matter what you're doing. Whether you're listening to a talk, you should be right here in the moment. Whether you are walking from the hall back to your hut in the evening, you should be present where you are. If you're halfway between the hall and your room, that's where your mind should be, with your body. And then whatever you're doing, if you're drinking a cup of tea, you're drinking a cup of tea. If you're resting at night, now's the time to rest. You're mindful of what you're doing. Present moment awareness throughout the day. You'll find that not only will that clear away a lot of unnecessary thinking, worrying, plans, duties, which aren't really your real duties in a meditation retreat, which are just extra things which I don't ask you to do, but which you take on for yourself, that mindfulness will give you more peace, a more sense of freedom, a more sense of actually being here on retreat rather than being somewhere else. Every moment of mindfulness in the present moment is a moment of being on retreat. Every moment when you're somewhere else, thinking, planning, talking, distracted, is a moment which you throw away, you discard. And so how many moments do you spend in a rains retreat? And how many more moments do we waste? And is that the reason why the meditation is not as profound and joyful as it might otherwise be? So by developing that mindfulness in one's daily activities, then one finds when one sits down to meditate, you have that clarity of mind. That clarity of mind will assist you to develop the other part of mindfulness, which is the panya part, the wisdom, the remembering the instructions, remembering what you're supposed to be doing. The process of meditation is very clearly described, and I've done my hardest to try and put those descriptions of meditation, as in the Anapanasati Sutta, into like a clear descriptive process. So you know exactly what's going on, what stage you're at, in the sense of what you should be doing now. So by putting it in stages, it becomes very clear. And that clarity will assist the mindfulness. If there's no mindfulness, there will be no clarity. You won't even remember the instructions. You won't know what you're supposed to be doing. And you can sit down cross-legged on a cushion for 1 hour, 2 hours. You're getting nowhere because there's no direction for the mind. The mind is like a programmable computer. The mind is very good. If you are clear and give it precise instructions, it will actually follow those. But a lot of times your meditation will be a waste because you don't give clear instructions, or the instructions which you do give are stupid instructions. They're not wise, they're not conducive to the goal. So make sure that with your mindfulness, when you begin every meditation, you give very clear instructions, exactly what this meditation is about, what you want it to do, where you're going, to give it direction. And by training yourself to get into the habit of every time you know, sit down on a cushion or a stool or whatever, and you close your eyes. You know, you begin by relaxing the body, and then you say, right, it's my meditation time now. This is what meditation's all about. And this is where you can use the mindfulness in the sense of memory to recall your experiences so far in meditation. And especially just recall the major hindrances you have in meditation. Whether it's lust, or whether it's anger, or whether it's sloth and torpor, or thinking too much, restlessness, or doubt, whichever those five hindrances it is, or whatever other form of those five hindrances you've noticed in your practice, you know, whether it's sort of daydreaming or fantasizing or whatever. Whatever is your problem, your major problem, remind yourself of that at the beginning of every meditation. Now you know what those problems are, you've experienced them so often. Now you're starting to meditate, remind yourself. It might be, say, sloth and torpor. If it's the morning meditation, you've just got up. Now, if so far during this meditation retreat you haven't had a very clear and sharp morning meditation yet, when you get up at 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock, whatever time it is, when you get up there and you wash your face and go to the toilet, whatever you do to begin with, and you sit down with mindfulness and clear comprehension, exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. And then sort of do the preliminaries, get yourself comfortable, relax, and then remind yourself that sloth and torpor is my big problem. So many times in the morning, this has got me. And what mindfulness can do, it can program the mind to beware, to be alert to that particular danger. It's a simile which I've given before, which I'm reminding each one of you now, which has proved very effective in my own meditation, the simile of the snake. That simile goes like this. In Thailand, when I was a young monk, in the forest monasteries there in Wat Pa Phong and also Wat Nanachat, We had flashlights. Sometimes we didn't have bulbs for them. We had to wait for months to get a new bulb. But more likely, we didn't have flashlight batteries. I remember going to Ajahn Chah's hut once. My flashlight batteries were really dead. I mean, you couldn't see anything with them. And I asked, can I have some more flashlight batteries? And he looked at me and said, we've got none. There are no flashlight batteries. So that I had to sort of walk back, you know, from the halls from Ajahn Chah's hut in the middle of the night, and there were snakes in that monastery, and there were centipedes, which were supposed to hurt even more than snakes, and there were ants all over the place, really big biting ants, and you had to be very careful, because otherwise you'd get bitten, and you know, sometimes if it was a snake, you know, you could die. So because I knew that there were those snakes on the path somewhere, even without a flashlight, I'd always see them, you know, in the starlight or in the moonlight. And that was thick forest in Wat Pa Phong, but you could just about see something, you know, dark across the path. And you go along another path just in case, or you'd jump over it or something. But the point was that because I'd alerted myself to the danger, every time I walked in that forest at night without a flashlight, I alerted myself first of all. Therefore, I always saw the problem before it was too late, and I could skirt around it. In the same way in meditation, whatever that problem is in your meditation, I gave the example of sloth and torpor at the beginning of a meditation, tell yourself, this is my snake, this is my problem. And you're walking through a dense forest because your mindfulness and alertness isn't that strong yet. So I'm going to be very careful of this black and dark shape just across my path, which can so easily strangle me, kill me, suffocate me. And so when you actually say that to yourself, you're programming mindfulness. You're setting up mindfulness in one particular area which you'll find extremely helpful. And once you program the mind that way, programming mindfulness that way, and you leave it alone, you sort of go off and watch your breath or loving kindness, whatever happens, and you will find that when the mind starts to get tired into sloth and torpor, when it's approaching you, something in the mind notices that. Lights click on in the mind. The program starts to work. And you say, sloth and torpor's coming. You notice it before it can get you. That's the job of mindfulness. The attention, which is what mindfulness is, a bare attention, because you programmed it, switches and notices the danger. Remember, mindfulness only has one object. If you're watching the breath, the breath, the breath, the breath, you don't notice the other objects like sloth and torpor. If I was watching the trees, I wouldn't be watching the ground as I walk through the forest. But then, when the corner of my eye caught a snake, straight away, because of the programming, my eyes would go straight to it. They'd go down onto the floor of the forest, and I'd see it and avoid it. And so if that mindfulness has been programmed to look out for sloth and torpor, it will see it coming. And it will take evasive action. A lot of times, whether it's lust or anger, fantasy, or whatever else which stops you gaining success in meditation, it creeps up on you so often without you seeing it. You lose the breath, you lose your mind, your meditation object, and you don't know why. It's because you weren't programming your mindfulness. So it's not just a case, I'll be mindful, I'll be mindful. Tell your mindfulness where to watch and what to do. Telling it what to do is the job again of sampajanya, of wisdom. So you've heard many talks and you've read many books. You all know what to do when these particular problems come up. Very often, sloth and torpor, because its antidote is mindfulness, alertness, that's all you need to do with that hindrance, just to notice it coming, to see it clearly. And then when you are mindful of sloth and torpor can't get you anymore. And with these other hindrances, like lust or sensory desire, just to program yourself that this is my hindrance, this has got me many times. Beginning of your meditation, once you've settled down, tell mindfulness what to look out for. And if that lust or sensory desire starts coming up, again, then you know what to do about it. And what to do about it is actually usually seeing the danger in it. When you see the danger in it, that something happens in your mind, you say, I don't want to buy into that anymore. Now, you've told yourself, with sexual fantasies, with dreaming about sort of food or planning to go here or doing that, all of that sort of stuff, you know just how much time it's wasted. So you tell yourself the danger of these things. I don't want to get involved in these things anymore. I want some peace. And so you tell yourself, you warn yourself, that's your snake. And it means that when these things, they start to creep up on you, you can do something about it straight away. In the suttas, there's this beautiful simile of the Malawa creeper. There's a big tree in the forest, and this little creeper starts to shoot at the ground of this, at the foot of this tree. And this small little creeper, when it winds its tendrils around the tree, this little creeper is just so soft, with little hairs on its very soft and green tendrils. And the tree thinks, isn't this nice? It just feels so sensuous to be stroked by this little creeper. And what danger can this little creeper have on me? It's fun, it's enjoyable. But of course, what happens next is that creeper soon grows and gets not soft and tender anymore, but just very, very stiff and strong and harsh and suffocating. And it kills that tree eventually. It pulls it all over and kills it. It's the same with that sensory lust, and that was what the simile meant in the Buddha's teachings. Be careful, because when it first comes into the mind, it's just so soft and so much fun. It's so just tender, and it's no danger at all, you think. The first thoughts of sensory lust which come up, you think, I can stop this any time. But then, just like the Malava creeper, sort of before you know it, it's got you by the throat and by many other parts of your anatomy, and it's got you and it's pulled you over. And sometimes it means you can't live the monastic life anymore. or you can't be at peace in monastic life. And you lose so much happiness and so much possibility of enlightenment and freedom. So you look upon these things as a marl of a creeper, as something which when it starts is just so soft and lovely, but which you know is going to kill you like a murderer, insinuating itself into your presence, into your household, into your mind. So warn yourself that that is the danger at the beginning of every meditation. And if that's your big problem in monastic life, lust, warn yourself of that. And every time you meditate, whether it's once a day, 10 times a day, 100 times a day, warn yourself of that, program that mind. And you'll find that mind, when it's programmed, that mindfulness is trained and taught, you'll be able to overcome those problems very easily. Mindfulness will see it coming. And the mindfulness will become sharp, in the same way that mindfulness becomes sharp of dangers, like snakes, or whatever else you're on the lookout for. And so this way that mindfulness does its job of guiding you into powerful and deep meditations. If it's anger, you know the antidote is loving kindness. Anger is because of the fault-finding mind. You stop fault-finding, you go into seeing the positive. You go from unpleasant nimittas to pleasant nimittas, subha nimittas. And those subha nimittas, subha means like beautiful, pleasant. It means seeing the beautiful and pleasant in whatever you're doing. Whether it's the beautiful and pleasant in the breath, the beautiful and pleasant in meditation, the beautiful or pleasant in the talk, the beautiful and pleasant in this hall, in this monastery. In every aspect of experience, there's always both the pleasant and unpleasant to be seen by your perception. And to overcome ill will and negativity, you actually develop, you tell the mind, okay, in meditation, start to look for the beauty in just meditation posture. Now look for the benefits of just being at peace. I don't have to give a talk, I don't have to sweep the ground, I don't have to wash the dishes, I don't have to write letters, I don't have to do anything. So that beauty of just rest and peace and freedom of not having to do things, it can be what makes a subha nimitta. So that aspect of the experience which is beautiful, pleasant, enjoyable, wonderful. And so you train mindfulness to see the subha nimitta in your meditation practice. In not just with the breath, but just with the fact you're sitting down and you have nothing to do. Because when you train the mindfulness to notice subha nimittas, then you want to meditate. You just love sitting down. And you don't have to force yourself. One of the problems with monks who've been monks a long, long, long time is they've done so much meditation that sometimes the initial gloss and the interest can very easily wear out. And so if you've been a monk for a long, long time, the meditation is not all that hot. Sometimes it's very easy to just say, well, I'll meditate later and I'll do these projects instead. Be careful of that. Because, you know, you're not here to do projects. You don't get enlightened by doing things. You get enlightened on the meditation cushion or stool or chair or whatever it is. So remember that, and to be able to get into those, to get the mind wanting to meditate, just train the mind to see the subha nimitta in meditation. See the subha nimitta, the beautifulness in present moment awareness. See the joy in silence. See the wonder in the breath. See the beauty in nimittas. And each of these occasions which occur in meditation, just to train mindfulness to look out for the beauty and not to look out for the faults. And if you can do that in your meditation, you might even take that practice to daily life as well. You know, when it's the food, you train yourself to see the appreciation of the food you get or the breakfast you get. When it's time to do chores in the monastery, just instead of developing asubha nimittas, just why do I have to wash the dishes, why do I have to sweep the floor, why do I have to do the dharana sala, why do I have to receive the food, They develop a subanimitta, the perception of the beauty. Isn't it wonderful I've got this opportunity to serve the monastery? Isn't it great that I have the possibility of making good karma? Because whatever you do in this monastery is nearly always magnificent good karma. So you actually put happiness and joy and positive energy into what you're doing. And it means it becomes fun, whatever you're doing in this monastery. Now, whether it's talking to people after the meal like I have to do, or whether it's giving talks or writing letters or receiving phone calls. Now, I have to do a lot in this monastery, but I develop subanimitas with it, so I enjoy it. No matter what I'm doing, I've got to do it, so I might as well make it fun. It's my philosophy. I've got to meditate, so I might as well make it fun. My goodness, you've got nothing else to do in this monastery, so you might as well make it fun, otherwise you're going to have a hell of a time. And that's in the negative sense of hell of a time. So put fun in the meditation, develop supanimitta, and the way to do that is tell mindfulness. Instruct it. If you're going to meditate, mind, go and look for the fun in it. Look for the happiness. Look for the joy. Look for the beauty in the present moment. And if you tell your mindfulness that at the very beginning, then you'll find you are directing mindfulness. You are training it. You are establishing it. If you just say, I'm going to be mindful no matter what happens, then you find that meditation doesn't work so well because you're not directing it into areas which give rise to results, to fruits, to what's there for you in meditation. So you direct the mindfulness in that way. As you get deeper into meditation, there are other problems come up. And wherever you get stuck in your meditation, just at the end of every meditation, that's the time for mindfulness to reflect back on what you've been doing. To look back, see what you did, see what worked, see what didn't work, and then train mindfulness again. Say, mind, this is what happened. This worked, that didn't work. Now this is the result of beautiful meditation. It feels so good, it feels so peaceful, it feels so wonderful. And tell the mind that. This is again training mindfulness. Because if you tell yourself at the end of every meditation, notice how wonderful it is, because every meditation is much better than if you didn't meditate at all. And if you tell yourself that, instruct the mind that in that way, then mindfulness will remember. And you are generating inclinations of the mind. Inclinations of the mind to peace, to joy, to stillness. Because you're telling it, this is good, this is wonderful. You're recollecting what it feels like to be peaceful. And you find that has a powerful effect on the mind. You are deliberately training mindfulness. And if you do that, you'll find that the mind will want to meditate more and more, will incline to stillness more and more. You're actually weakening the defilements of the mind. And as you do that, it becomes easier and easier to meditate. You incline towards peacefulness. Sometimes that inclination towards peacefulness, or that inclination to go inwards, that inclination to stillness, that inclination to calm, but that's incredibly powerful. Sometimes that's all you need to get into deep jhanas. Because you're inclining the mind to peacefulness, and the mind thinks it's just the beginning stages of meditation, that inclination gets so strong it just carries you. Just like a powerful current, much further than you intended to go. But it carries you right to the very heart of the meditation, to stillness, to joy, to the bliss of the jhanas. So developing these inclinations by training mindfulness is extremely productive. And any problems and difficulties in the meditation, the deeper stages, such as fear which can come up, or control which comes up, tell mindfulness again and again and again, look, at those deeper stages, it's not the time to control. It's the time to let go. And the more you tell yourself that, the more you train yourself in that way, you will find that what happens when you come to the deeper stages of meditation, that something arises in the mind which says, let go, don't control. And sometimes I've seen that happen in my own meditation. I wonder where that's come from. Because in those subtle states of mind, it's so difficult to form any sort of choice or will. The mind is so still, it doesn't want to do anything. And you're just running, basically, on your on your inclinations. And if your inclination is to control, that's what you do at that stage, and you mess everything up. If your inclination is to be afraid and not let go of things, then that's what happens at that particular stage. But if you train yourself beforehand, and something comes up at that particular stage, it comes up because of the training you've done before. There's a causal link there, how you program your mindfulness and what happens at that particular stage. And the something comes up in the mind, be still, just let go, don't do anything. You wondered who actually said that, where that direction came from. And if you're smart, you know where it came from, because that's what you told yourself a long time ago. And it means that you abandon those finer upikilesas, those defilements of the mind, which stand between you and the high attainments. And then after you gain those deep meditations, within those meditations, as I keep on saying, you can't say or do anything. You are frozen. But you are frozen with huge awareness. When you come out afterwards and you can reflect back upon those stages, which is almost automatic that you have to do those things because they're so powerful, you have to say, what's that? When you look back, then you actually start to understand just how powerful this thing called mindfulness can be. Just the degree of alertness, awakeness, which is there. And this is an important part of the Dhamma, to actually to know just power mindfulness or superpower mindfulness, as I wrote in that recent journal. And when you look back and compare the mindfulness within jhana, which stays when you come out of jhana, to just the ordinary mindfulness, you realize just how weak is the ordinary mindfulness of daily life. Just the mind is just like a flashlight with just very, very low batteries. You can hardly see where you're going. Like sometimes what I used to do in the forest in Thailand when you didn't have a flashlight, you used to just light matches. You light a match and quickly see where you are. And then, of course, the match would very quickly burn out and blow out. So while the match was alight, you'd see where you go and run that distance. And then when the match went out and you couldn't see where you were again, you're in the dark, and then you light another match. And you can need about 4 or 5 matches, you know, to go to the end of the path, sometimes more than that. But those matches, they don't give you much illumination. You can imagine like getting a huge army searchlight. And that's what like superpower mindfulness is like. The mindfulness in jhana, which is so sharp and so precise. And then you realize that that is a type of mindfulness which is required, you know, to gain the deep insights, to understand the deep truths of the nature of the mind and of, you know, the body and of life. Because sometimes the way the mind works, we think we're mindful of the defilements, you know, greed, hatred and delusion. But with ordinary mindfulness, you can only be alert to the grosser forms of those defilements. But you know, the ones which are the, as it were, the most powerful, the secret agents of greed, hatred and delusion, the ones which work undercover in the mind, just the ordinary mindfulness just cannot catch those. And that's why that sometimes one thinks one is being mindful and then lust just obsesses the mind. Or anger just comes up and you don't know where did that come from. Or just gross stupidity. And the reason is because your mindfulness was not sharp enough, was not bright enough, and couldn't see those anusayas, those underlying tendencies, which create so much havoc in the mind. With superpower mindfulness, with that huge power of the mind after a jhana, that the hindrances have been abandoned and the mind is bright and brilliant, radiant as it says in the suttas, then whatever you look at, as you look at the mind, you can see so clearly just why it inclines, you know, to lust, why it inclines to anger, to ill will, why it inclines to delusion, to fear, to guilt, to grief, to planning and wanting something else. You can actually see that so clearly because your mind is like a searchlight. It's just so powerful, which can illuminate even the dark corners of samsara. And when you start to see these things, you can actually understand just, you know, the wanting which comes up from the mind. You know, the craving, where that comes from. You know, from the controller, from the doer. Whenever is that the controller and the doer there, there'll always be wanting. There'll always be doing. All restlessness, all activity, all wanting to go here or come there, the wanting to make this or complete that. Why do we do things in this monastery when we don't really have to? We do that because of the controller, the doer. And if you can actually use that superpower mindfulness, real mindfulness, to bore in this particular case, you are directing it inside, into the nature of the mind, what you take to be yourself. You focus right in there, and you can see this little thing in there, which is a sense of self, which always wants to do something, to actualize its existence. And once you actually start to see that, you realize that's where all the activity, all the restlessness, all the greed, the lust, so we're wanting to do something, to go somewhere, anywhere than just be here. Go off into fantasies, to dreams and to plans. And we always justify those things as being really important. We tell, you know, we have to do these things, we tell ourselves. We don't have to do them at all. The only thing you have to do in this monastery is to meditate. Sit down and let go and abandon everything. All, as I said here, and I'll repeat this again, all of your duties which you have to do, you don't have to do. If you're meditating and getting into jhana, you don't have to do any of your duties in this monastery. No matter whether it's looking after me as upatak, whether it's sweeping the grounds, whether it's whatever, meditation takes priority, takes precedence. So when I'm saying you don't have to do these duties, I don't mean that you don't have to do these duties so you can sleep in. Sleep doesn't take precedence in this monastery. Doing your own little projects doesn't take precedence. What takes precedence is like letting go of the defilements, enjoying the beautiful, blissful states of meditation, developing wisdom. That's what we're here for. That's what this monastery is here for. To create arahats, to create anagamis, once returners or stream winners. That's what we're creating in this place, to get people into jhanas. In one of those suttas, I think it's the Sandaka Sutta, the Buddha said that, Ananda was saying, the consolation of the holy life, of monastic life, is only the first consolation is when you get first jhana. If you don't get any of those jhanas, he said there's no consolation of living the holy life. Okay, you know, you make good karma and those sorts of things, but you can make good karma as a layperson. So get those jhanas, get those attainments on the path. That's what this is all about. It's not about having the biggest monastery in the Western world. It's not about having the cleanest monastery in the Western world. It's not about spreading the Dhamma. Everyone is spreading the Dhamma, but no one's practicing the Dhamma. No one's realizing the Dhamma. Always spreading other people's Dhamma. They're not realizing their own Dhamma. And one enlightened being is so much more useful to the world than thousands of books. This is what the world really needs at the moment. It's just more enlightened beings, more Aryas in the world. So to be able to do that, we need a superpower mindfulness which can see that where all this is coming from, and just this ego, this self, this doer inside of us, which unless we actually see that and realize that's the problem, unless mindfulness knows that, there'll always be some sort of restlessness, some sort of doing, some sort of project, some sort of going. When you actually see that, you realize it's the doer which is a problem. And then you can actually use that mindfulness in your meditation. And just make sure that when you sit down here, that doer, that controller, that maker, that house builder, that you see that in your meditation, say, that's my real big snake, the doer. So you sit there in your meditation and say, that's the one I'm going to put all my mindfulness on. Watching the breath, but that's the one I'm looking out for as I walk along the path. No doing, please. And as soon as you spot the doer starting to open its mouth, you tape it over with masking tape. You stop it. Mindfulness can do that once it knows what the real problem is. And once you actually see the doer, the controller in your meditation, and put your mindfulness on that, you just sit down there and you just don't do anything. And then all that meditation process starts to happen all by itself. As far as the hindrances are concerned, lust, sensory desire, that's one particular type of doing. Ill will is another type of doing. Restlessness and remorse, another type of doing. Even sloth and torpor is a type of doing. It's escaping from the present moment, going somewhere where you don't have to feel. So you think, but what you do feel is a very sort of dull and unpleasant, foggy sort of state. There's no real escape at all. It's like being in a prison, dark and gloomy. And doubt is another type of doing. So just make the mind peaceful. That's what samatha means. It's calming down the doer so you can really be at peace and you can rest and take it easy at last. In the monk's Vinaya, the last seven rules of the 227 rules for a monk, is called the Adhikarana Samatha. Adhikarana means business, Samatha means quelling, settling, finishing it all up, so there's no more business at all. And I really love that phrase of Adhikarana Samatha, of settling down all the business, getting all the business finished. And how do you get all the business finished? Not by getting it out of the way, because if you get it out of the way, there's always more business comes up later. There's always something to be done in a monastery. So getting things out of the way, writing all your letters, sweeping all the paths, making the perfect monastery, it never gets out of the way. The only way to get things out of the way is say, right now, doesn't matter what business is here, I'm not going to do anything. You get the doer out of the way. That inside of you, which is always forcing you to go somewhere else, to change what's happening now, to fly somewhere else. That's the doer, which moves you. There is something in the suttas called asavas, the outflowings of the mind. Once there is a doer there, it forces the attention away and outside. The mind flows out into the world. It flows out into the world of books, out into the world of landscaping, building, out into the world of travel, out into the world of food, out into the world of sex, out into the world of movies, music, out into the world of the future, the past. Just goes out and out and out and out. All coming from the doer, making you move, making you tremble. Once you see that, the only way to stop the asavas, actually to bring them to a sense of peace and tranquility, to samatha them, is seeing their source, the doer, the source of craving. And just quelling it. Say, no doing. And this is how the meditation works. that when you actually see with mindfulness that particular defilement, the root of craving, then you can learn how to just to let go, to open up the present moment, open up the silence, open up the breath. Instead of always trying to move somewhere else, you move inside, move in to whatever's happening now. Moving in is just the natural sinking into the moment, sinking into the silence, which happens when you're not doing anything. You settle down, you settle in, you move in. And when this starts to happen, you realize just how easy it is to meditate and why it was so difficult to meditate before, because you were always doing that meditation and the mindfulness never saw just the root cause of failure in meditation, always wanting to control it, to do it, to make it, to force it. Instead, you realize that you just instruct mindfulness at the very beginning. This is what you want to do now. And then you shut up and let mindfulness do its job. Mindfulness does the meditation, not the doer. And as that happens, you incline in and in and in and in. Mindfulness starts to experience the joys of meditation, the peace of meditation, the wonder of meditation. There's a fascination of meditation. The world of the mind is far more fascinating than any movie. It's far more enjoyable than any sex. It just is far more productive than any book you can write or monastery you can build. And you experience these things. This is the way. This is what you should be doing as a monk, as a novice, anagarika, layman, lay woman, visitor here. These are beautiful states. So stop talking about them. Stop doing them. And just experience them instead. Stop talking, stop doing. Experience them. And by experiencing them, it means just focusing on that doer, knowing what the problem is, knowing where it is, knowing what I'm talking about by a doer, by a controller, going to the source of that. And you know, all words are signposts, and all signposts point to a reality. So don't just stop at the word controller or doer. Follow that word to its meaning. Now look in that direction, and when you see the meaning of the word doer, of controller, understand what it truly is, then you can have that mindfulness to be able to quieten it down. When you quieten it down and make it peaceful, when there's no doer going on, then how can there be any hindrance? How can there be any sort of lust? How can there be any ill will, any restlessness, worry, sloth and torpor? Any doubt, the hindrances stop right there. And just the mind just flows effortlessly into beautiful states of meditation. So this is the easy way to meditate, because mindfulness is alert, bright, and knows the dangers, knows the problems. And when you can do that in meditation, and you know how to settle down the problems in meditation, you also just see the great insights of the Buddha, the Third Noble Truth, the reason for Nibbana happening. You know, is Chaga, giving up, Patinissaga, relinquishing, Mutti, freeing, Analaya, not allowing this doer to roost in the mind, not allowing this doer to make its home inside of you. Sort of making craving homeless. And if you can actually do that, make craving a place which can never settle in you, then of course there's freedom there. And it's Nibbana. You know, the joy of freedom. You know, the joy of not wanting. The joy of not having to keep doing. And keep moving. And always like the dog with mange in the Buddha's simile, which Ajahn Chah was most fond of. A dog with mange tries to get rid of that itch in the forest, then it goes and runs into the open air, then into a cave, then into the water. Wherever it goes, the mange goes with it. It's that doer, the controller, the craving. That's what I'm talking about here, the source of craving. Once one can actually notice that, see the root problem, then just like a doctor, once you know, diagnose what the problem is, then healing can start from that point. You can cure the problem. You can let go and at last find some peace in your life and find just how easy it is to do meditation. Wouldn't that be nice just to be able to go back to your hut at any time? Even if you're tired, you've been working, even if you're sick and got a sort of a bad body, even if you're very tired, just go and sit there and just cross your legs and just not do anything and have fun at any time. Get into deep meditations at any time without difficulty, at ease. As it says in the suttas, that's what arahats could do. They get into jhanas at ease without any problem or difficulty, without any trouble. How can you do that? That's how you do it. So develop that mindfulness, first of all, throughout the day. Next, when you meditate, be careful when you're meditating. Don't just do it like perfunctorily, just because you've been doing it for so many years and you get into the bad habits. You just sit down and just, you're not really knowing what you're doing or where you're supposed to go. You just sit down and just do it because that's what you're supposed to do as a monk. Be methodical. Be careful. Mindfulness can be very, very powerful if you know how to train it. Train that mindfulness. It's in your interest. It'll make you happy for a long time. Train that mindfulness to be alert. Tell it what the snakes are, the dangers are. Train it to be alert to those things. Now, you all know what your problems are in monastic life, what the difficulties are. Tell mindfulness that. You don't need to tell the teacher to tell someone else. Tell mindfulness that. Train yourself through that process of programming your mindfulness. And then you actually are truly training. When you're truly training, then things happen. And monastic life gets lighter. You start feeling success in monastic life. Things work. Happiness comes. Meditation deepens. Insight starts to flow. And you realize just the fruits of the monastic life. And eventually, as I say, you see the doer themselves sitting in your jitta and seeing that there's a root cause of the craving. And you just shut that up. And so whenever you want to be quiet, you can be quiet. Whenever you have to do something, you can get the doer going and put forth a lot of effort. When it's time to do nothing, you can know that switch inside the mind to shut off the doer, because mindfulness has seen that. And mindfulness can turn that on and off whenever it wants, when you tell it to. And that's a way you can get deep meditation and have a lot of fun and joy in your monastic life. So that's a brief talk this evening on mindfulness. So please put that into practice. If you haven't had good meditation yet, that's well worth focusing on, well worth practicing, reminding yourself that this is a way to develop deep meditation, happiness, insight, freedom, liberation, the whole works. A1.
Sāvaka-saṅgho, saṅgāṁ namāmi.